Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Alzheimer's disease, which carries such tragic baggage for victims and their families, also carries something else, stigma. We're going to be talking about that on today's program after a discussion about some promising potential for preventing the disease altogether. Washington University has received a sizable grant to jumpstart clinical trials aimed at preventing Alzheimer's and those genetically predisposed to it. The research will be directed through Washington University's Dominantly Inherited Alzheimer's Network, or DIAN, Therapeutic Trials Unit. Joining me in studio to talk about the trials are Dr. John Morris, who directs the Alzheimer's Research Center at Washington University School of Medicine. Joe Heinrichs is a study participant. His father had inherited Alzheimer's, and Joe has a 50% chance of developing the disease. He joins us by phone from outside Davenport, Iowa. A little later, we'll be joined by Tiffany Phillips, the professional and family education coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association here in St. Louis. I thank you, Joe, and I thank you, Doctor, for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Looking forward to have Tiffany with us in just a couple of moments. Doctor, I'll begin with you, if I may. Fill me in on inherited Alzheimer's. It's a term I'm not quite familiar with. We've heard about people who might be genetically predisposed. Is this the same thing?
No. This is a very rare form of Alzheimer's disease that is caused by a bad gene, a mutation. And they are very rare. Less than 1% of all people with Alzheimer's disease have this form. But it's characterized by early onset. So typically, the illness, the symptoms of the illness begin in the 50s or 40s or even in the 30s. And it is also characterized, as you mentioned, by the fact that each child of a parent who is affected has this bad mutation has a 50-50 chance of inheriting that mutation. If they inherit that mutation, they are destined to develop Alzheimer's disease. If they don't inherit it, they're at no greater risk than anyone else.
Joe Heinrichs, can you tell us what your situation is? We know about your father, of course. Tell us about your experience in learning about this.
Well, my dad was diagnosed back in 1980, and died of Alzheimer's at the age of 50. I have a couple cousins who died at early ages. I have a cousin who died at the age of 44 and another cousin who died at 50 from my uncle. I have another uncle who does not have Alzheimer's, has lived up to, I believe he's about 80 years old now. And my uncle and my father had it. My grandmother had it, and then there were brothers and sisters of hers who did not. So we've been able to track it fairly well.
Why did you decide to become part of these trials that we're going to be talking about in just a moment?
Well, my family has said that we'll do anything we can to help help solve this mystery and see what we can do to defeat Alzheimer's.
But you do not, as I understand it, you do not want to know if, in fact, you have this mutant gene.
No. You know, if I start showing signs, I might say, yes, I want to find out. Or if there is a cure, I may want to find out. But my brothers and sisters and I, we all decided years ago that we weren't going to let this control our lives. I mean, it's definitely the elephant in the room. But that we wanted to continue our lives assuming we don't have it. And then, you know, if something does happen, we're all going to band together to take care of each other and defeat it.
Sure. Well, we all, of course, wish you the very best with regard to this, Joe. I'm going to take a couple of minutes now with the doctor to talk about these trials. Doctor, set this up for us. What exactly is going to be happening?
For 25 years, the Knight Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Washington University has developed evidence to show that the brain changes of Alzheimer's disease occur up to 20 years before the symptoms occur. So there's a long silent phase in which Alzheimer's disease is starting to affect the brain, but before it produces losses in memory and thinking. This preclinical stage, we think, is the optimal stage to try to treat with some specific drugs that hopefully will attack the process by which Alzheimer's disease destroys brain cells. We've been in a long phase now where we've had a number of treatment trials of people who have progressed on to having the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, Alzheimer's disease dementia, And unfortunately, none of those studies have been positive. All those trials have failed. We think it may not be that the drugs themselves aren't doing the trick. It's that they're administered too late in the process. So now with the DIAN study, we have documented that the brain changes occur at least 20 years, maybe 25 years before the symptoms, the Alzheimer's dementia occurs. And so that gives us this opportunity to intervene with specific drugs to attack the disease mechanism in people who do not have symptoms, at least yet, in hopes of delaying the onset of symptoms or even preventing their appearance. Prevention.
Well, talk about the format for this trial, if you will.
So we will enroll members of families with a known mutation that causes Alzheimer's disease, and we will most people, like Mr. Heinrichs in this study, do not know, nor do they wish to know, whether they carry a mutation. So we will enroll all comers from these families, those with a mutation and those without. But we will ensure that the people without a mutation will not get assigned the active drug, so they're not exposed to the side effects. But within the mutation carriers, and most of these people are asymptomatic, it's before the onset of symptoms, will be assigned to one of three drugs and will test to see if we can delay the brain process of Alzheimer's disease. The drug that works the best will be chosen then to go on to see if it delays or prevents the onset of the dementia.
One of the things that I have read about this is that you're having a rather unusual collaboration from the pharmaceutical industry in this project because typically they don't work as a consortium, but this is the opposite here.
I think everyone, scientists, family members, the pharmaceutical industry, the Food and Drug Administration that has to approve these trials, sees the immense value, the great potential for Alzheimer's disease prevention studies in the individuals who carry these gene mutations and are still asymptomatic. So we have a pharma consortium of 10 leading pharmaceutical companies that have banded together to provide industry support and to nominate their drug compounds for selection to go into the DIAN trials. My colleague at DIAN, Randy Bateman, from the Department of Neurology and the Knight Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, is leading this and is doing a terrific job.
How long will these trials be conducted?
We hope that the first phase of the trial to determine which drug does the best job of stopping the brain process of Alzheimer's disease, that we will be able to detect that effect within about 2 years. Then the next phase, the drug that works the best, we will then give over at least a 3-year period to see if it prevents the cognitive deterioration, the changes in memory and thinking.
Let's just assume, and we certainly hope, that this proves to be a very successful project and you come up with something that seems to work. What happens then with regard to all the other, the non-inherited folks? Is there like a vaccine or some preventive tablet that everybody will take?
Yeah, that's a great question. We don't know how well whatever we find in this very rare form of dominantly inherited Alzheimer's disease, we don't know how well it will translate to the far more common form of Alzheimer's disease that typically occurs in older age. However, there is a lot of similarities in the way the diseases progress, the early onset disease versus the late onset disease. And we think the key proteins that are involved are the same for both forms. So we have great hope that what we do discover in these DIAN trials will generalize to later onset Alzheimer's disease, which clearly is the big target and the big need.
If, in fact, you don't know, even those who don't know which of the people involved in the trial have or do not have the mutant gene, then how are you going to be able to determine in those people whether or not the drug works?
So we will know. The research team will know because we will do the genotyping, take the blood, and we'll make certain that we have accurate assignments. Of course, it's very important that only a very select – group of people know this mutation status because this is very confidential information, and we don't want this people who are administering the tests and determining whether there is a drug effect to know so that they're not biased. But we will make the assignments based upon our knowledge of the genetic mutation.
Before we went on the air, you said this is perhaps the most exciting news you've ever heard.
So as I mentioned, we've been working on this for some 25 years, and I have to say we've come a long way in understanding Alzheimer's disease, but part of that understanding is just how complicated and how complex this illness is. And I'm afraid that we do not have truly effective therapies to show after 25 years of research. But I'm very optimistic that this study, because it's not trying to treat the symptoms of someone who with Alzheimer's disease dementia, we know by the time dementia is present, the brain is already badly damaged. But now the optimism is we're going to try to intervene at an early enough phase before dementia symptoms to prevent substantial brain damage and hopefully prevent the onset of the illness.
What is it about Alzheimer's that is so mystifying and that has prevented much progress in dealing with it?
Well, the brain is just a very complicated organ, and this is a widespread brain disease that causes brain cells and their connections with each other to wither and to die. And I'm afraid that the lack of knowledge about Alzheimer's disease has prevented us from getting a proper handle on how to intervene effectively. That is the power of this DIAN study. We know how these mutations cause brain cells to die. We can intervene at a time to try to prevent the brain cells from being damaged and lost.
What are the chances of someone who doesn't have this mutant gene? What are the chances of someone who is the offspring of someone who has Alzheimer's contracting it?
So there are other ways that genes can put one at greater risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. So we often hear that Alzheimer's disease runs in families. Very rarely does it run in family because there's a known mutation that causes Alzheimer's. But we can inherit a genetic profile from our parents that may make us more susceptible to developing Alzheimer's. At the same token, we can develop a genetic profile that protects us against developing Alzheimer's. So there is a family association, but it's not causing Alzheimer's disease. It's just putting us at greater risk.
That's Dr. John Morris, director of the Alzheimer's Research Center at Washington University School of Medicine. We're talking about clinical trials that are going to begin in a couple of months in which they're seeking ways to possibly prevent Alzheimer's in certain types of patients. With us by phone from the Quad Cities area is Joe Heinrichs. He's a participant in this forthcoming trial that I have talked about. We'll come back and continue our conversation with him in just a moment. And we'll also take your calls at 382-8255 or 382-TALK. If you'd like to send us an email, do so at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on air or reach us through Facebook. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back to our conversation about Alzheimer's disease in general, but more specifically, we're talking about a clinical trial that is going to be getting underway through the Washington University School of Medicine in just a matter of months now, actually weeks, I suppose, in which it's hoped that when the trial is over, they'll have some sense of what can be done and what drugs might be used to prevent Alzheimer's in certain cases. We are talking in studio with Dr. John Morris from the Washington University School of Medicine. Joe Heinrichs is with us by phone from the Quad Cities area. He is going to be a participant in the forthcoming trial. And Tiffany Phillips of the Alzheimer's Association is going to be joining us in just a little while. We'll be talking with her about the stigma of Alzheimer's. But Joe, I want to come back to you, and thanks for being so patient as the doctor was filling us in on some of the things that we need to know about Alzheimer's to get this conversation going. I'm curious about your sense of self wading through this period. I know you've indicated that you don't want to really know if you have this mutant gene. However, what is it like to live with Alzheimer's literally all around you?
I don't know how to answer that. It's just a part of our lives, and I think that it has brought my family closer. You know, we all had to deal with taking care of Dad, and it definitely, we were all very young. I was a senior in high school. My youngest sister was six, and, you know, our roles all had to reverse to taking care of Dad, and I think it got us all growing up a little sooner than we usually would, but it also made us a very, very tight family.
There must be an element of fear, I would think, knowing that this potential is out there.
There is. You know, I had to make, you know, when Dad was first diagnosed, I swore, you know what, I'm never going to get married, I'm never going to have children, so on and so forth. But then I thought about it, I'm not going to let this disease control my life. And my brothers and sisters, we all made that conscious decision. And if we had let Alzheimer's control us, you know, I wouldn't have the three wonderful boys that I have and the nieces and nephews that I have, you know. So we decide, you know, we've all made these conscious decisions. I have a sister who isn't married. I have a brother who just got married. And they're struggling with whether or not, you know, they want to have children in the future. But that's their decision to deal with.
Doctor, if, in fact, Joe does have this gene that we're talking about, what are the chances that his children would? Still 50-50 for them as well?
Right. So each offspring, each child of a person who carries the mutation has a 50-50 chance. That may mean that each child would inherit the gene. It could be that each child does not inherit the mutation. But I would say on average, and Mr. Heinrichs, you can tell us this, for your family tree, your family pedigree, roughly in each generation, about half the individuals are affected and half are not. And typically this goes through multiple generations. So maybe Mr. Heinrichs, you would like to tell us how far back you've been able to trace this in your own family.
Well, my father first started looking into this. I think it goes back four generations. I think he took it back to Germany, is how it goes. And I haven't looked at the family tree in a long time to answer that specifically. But yes, you can see quite a few families where, you know, distant cousins and the like who are not affected by it. And then you see their stream, their strain, it's free and clear.
Joe, you're coming to a symposium that is being held at Washington University School of Medicine on Friday on this very issue. What message do you bring? Why are you coming?
We're coming to encourage the doctors to get this cured, quite specifically. They want to know how it affects our lives, and my family's pretty open and honest about it. We took part in trials years ago, and some of the questions we're going to be asked about that is, you know, how was it going through those trials and why did we do it? And just answering some of the questions that you're asking today.
Doctor, if everything goes positively with regard to all of this, and you've said that the trials are going on for a couple of years, how long would it take, do you think, to get to the point where products are on the market to deal with it?
Well, it's possible that it could, if the trials are successful, that's a big if.
Sure.
But if they are successful, it's possible that the power of this study would be recognized by the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and it's possible that approval of the drug could be rendered, at least for these individuals with early onset Alzheimer's disease caused by a mutation. The larger question is, if these trials are successful, how soon they might be available for the far greater number of people with late onset Alzheimer's disease not caused by a mutation.
How important is this? Before I go to the phones, I understand that it costs $200 billion a year to Medicare and Medicaid to deal with Alzheimer's disease, that 300,000 people with Alzheimer's in Missouri and Illinois, 5.5 million have it around this country, and of course there are many, many millions more around the world, and it is considered, in fact, an epidemic.
It is an epidemic, and of course it's fueled by the fact our society is growing older. More and more people live longer and longer. We're talking about a rare genetic form of Alzheimer's, but by far the most common risk factor is age. The more people that live longer, the more Alzheimer's we're going to get. And the baby boomers started turning 65 last year, that's going to make this a pandemic.
Let's go to the phones and get some listeners into the conversation. Sandra in Bridgeton, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm thrilled that you guys are finally talking about this, because every time I've heard an Alzheimer's thing, the rare form is never brought up. When my paternal grandmother died in 57, we were told, or my dad's family was told, it was Huntington's. And it took one of his brothers bequeathing his brainstem to the Huntington's research people. After 2 years of research on his brainstem, they came back and said, no, this is Alzheimer's. It's a very rare form. It traces back to a particular area of Germany. Only 14 clans in the U.S. have it. And that was basically all we were told. Half the people will die of it, and half of his siblings have died of it.
Thanks for the call, Sandra. Doctor?
Well, I think that this highlights a problem that you asked earlier, why we have struggled so much to try to find effective therapies, and I think there's still a lot of ignorance about what constitutes Alzheimer's disease and what does not, and getting a proper diagnosis has been difficult. So I think that's a very, very important observation, and hopefully these kinds of studies that are now going on will lead us not only to successful treatment trials, but also more accurate ways of making the diagnosis.
What about the German connection there? Is that is that a valid point she makes?
It is, but I have to say that there are these families with gene mutations all over the world. Our Diane study, although it's headquartered here at Washington University, is international. We have sites as far away as Australia. We have sites in Germany, United Kingdom. But some people travel from Libya, from India, from China. So it's all over the world.
And Joe, your family background is German. You mentioned your forebears came from Germany. Have you heard this connection between Alzheimer's and Germany in particular?
Well, sure. And actually, Dr. Alzheimer, the person who discovered this disease, you know, found it in Germany. And keep in mind that 50 years ago, at least in my family, and I think other families might vouch for this, it was the deep, dark secret. You didn't want to talk about, you know, your 30-year-old brother or sister who went nuts. People didn't understand what Alzheimer's was, and you hid it from the rest of society. At least from what I've been able to learn, our family tended to do that years and years ago.
The question of determining Alzheimer's, it comes to mind that not too many years ago, we never referred to Alzheimer's. We called people senile. When did your family know they were dealing with Alzheimer's instead of what might be called, have been called, senility?
Again, it goes back to probably when my grandmother died, and I believe that was like 1972, was one of the first autopsies that were done in our family. And it was around 70, 72 that we started finding out that it was Alzheimer's. We didn't know if it was Alzheimer's, if it was Pick's disease. There were a couple other diseases that they were trying to eliminate. And you really don't know until they're able to autopsy the brain.
Doctor, it would seem to me that if you autopsy the brain and you're finding out that it is, in fact, Alzheimer's, that we could learn more about it that way.
Well, I think we have learned a great deal from autopsy, but of course it's always, as I say, the brain is very complicated. So sometimes those autopsy findings are not as clear-cut as we might anticipate. But we are also moving away from having to wait until the person dies and the brain is studied at autopsy under the microscope. In the next few years, and maybe even sooner, we will have both fluid analyses from the spinal fluid, possibly from the blood, and imaging techniques to make the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease in living people. We won't have to wait for the autopsy. That's a big change that is on the horizon.
There's so much being done these days with regard to mapping the brain and studies of the brain, and yet this awful disease remains elusive.
Well, it has been elusive. It has been discouraging, the lack of truly effective therapies. But as we mentioned earlier, I think this potentially is the most exciting, most optimistic time in the field. We will be able to make better diagnoses and hopefully with the DIAN trials have the first evidence that there is a route that we can take that could prevent the dementia.
There are some fairly exciting things going on with gene therapy as well, are there not?
This is an exciting time in biomedical studies all over. But yes, we are learning so much more about how the genes put us at greater risk or protect us against diseases, and it's very exciting.
What have we learned most recently that is useful?
So a report that came out this summer is very exciting. It shows that a gene mutation that in a particular gene that is involved in generating a protein that affects an Alzheimer-type protein can protect against Alzheimer's. If you inherit this mutation, you don't get the disease, you're protected against the disease. And the importance of this is that it's the same protein that we think when dysregulated actually starts the disease. So this shows us that, yes, this protein called beta amyloid, when dysregulated, is a key factor in starting Alzheimer's. But if you have this gene that prevents amyloid beta from getting dysregulated, it actually protects you from getting Alzheimer's.
Joe, how closely do you follow the research?
Not as much as I should. My mother and my sister are very much on top of taking part in conference calls and the like and listening to it, and then they report back to us.
Doctor, is Joe fairly typical in his approach to this?
I think many people don't have the background to really absorb all of the scientific initiatives, but I think Mr. Heinrichs is remarkable in his willingness to be so proactive in the fight against Alzheimer's disease. So I applaud his efforts and that of his entire family. His mother has been particularly supportive of our efforts in DIAN, and we're looking forward to having the Heinrich family come to St. Louis later this week for the 8th Leonard Berg Symposium that will be held at the School of Medicine at Washington University that will be focused entirely on the idea, can we prevent Alzheimer's?
I have a couple of emails here I'd like to get to. One from Amy reads, my mom, that is, has early onset Alzheimer's. She was diagnosed at 59 but displayed symptoms much earlier. However, my dad does not want her to go through genetic testing to determine if she has the mutation because they don't want me to be afraid. I, however, want to know if she has the mutation and if I might inherit it, especially since I live in St. Louis near all of this groundbreaking research. How do I talk her and my dad into getting tested, or can I get tested without knowing if she has the mutation?
There is a process where in a family tree can be evaluated to see the likelihood that there's a mutation, either in the affected parent or in the child. If the affected parent, if it appears like multiple generations have had individuals with early onset disease and about half of the individuals in each generation are affected, then there is commercial testing where people can determine whether they are a gene carrier or not. This commercial testing, however, should only be considered after genetic counseling because the impact of knowing whether you are a mutation carrier has tremendous implications, including for not only psychologic reaction, which can be severe, but practical considerations, for example, insurability. So the implications of genetic testing, which is commercially available, should not take place without genetic counseling.
Joe, do you have any problems at all with insurance?
Not so far, no. Yeah. And that was another reason.
I get it.
Why we decided we did not want to know.
I certainly get that. Another email here, Warren from Creve Coeur asks, I've heard there is a link between Alzheimer's disease and insulin resistance. Is this true?
There is another exciting initiative being led by Suzanne Kraft from Wake Forest University that suggests that insulin can help treat the process of Alzheimer's disease. It's been a difficult study to really implement because giving insulin to in the blood, an infusion of insulin to try to get the insulin up to the brain, of course, is going to have ramifications for glucose levels in people who are not diabetic. But what Dr. Kraft has discovered is that you can administer insulin intranasally and bypass the bloodstream and then don't have to worry about altering blood sugar levels and see if that will be able to help individuals with Alzheimer's disease.
I have to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll continue our conversation on Alzheimer's, and we'll bring into the discussion Tiffany Phillips, who is with the St. Louis Alzheimer's Association. With me in studio, you just heard from Dr. John Morris from the Washington University School of Medicine, and joining us by phone from the Quad Cities area is Joe Heinrichs. He is a participant in a forthcoming clinical trial on Alzheimer's prevention. Key word, prevention. That's what they're hoping to be able to do, at least in some cases. We'll take more of your calls, too. We're going to be talking about the stigma of this disease with Tiffany in just a moment. Give us a call at 382-8255 or 382-TALK. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on Alzheimer's disease. We've been talking with Dr. John Morris of the Washington University School of Medicine in studio. Joe Heinrichs is joining us from the Quad Cities area. And now we're joined by Tiffany Phillips, who is Professional and Family Education Coordinator for the Alzheimer's Association of St. Louis. Tiffany, thanks for waiting, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stigma. It's something that the association is very much concerned with. A report has just recently come out suggesting ways to deal with it, so it must be a pretty big deal.
It really is. One of the things that's interesting about this report is that 75% of the people who responded who are living with dementia and around 64% of their care partners all agreed that there are these stigmas and negative connotations that are associated with having Alzheimer's disease.
Such as?
Well, there's this, I guess part of it is not understanding the disease, but there's this thought that if on Wednesday I don't have a diagnosis, and then on Thursday I get the news from my doctor that this change has taken place inside me and I'm no longer able to communicate the way I was the day before.
And people, when they discover that someone they know or love has Alzheimer's disease, their attitude toward them changes.
It can. A lot of people will hide their diagnosis from family and friends because they don't want to feel like they're being treated differently. They're afraid that their ideas about anything will be discounted or seen as less than because they happen to be a person living with Alzheimer's disease.
Joe, can you relate to this subject we're talking about, stigma, with in your family? There's been so much of it. What has your experience been?
Well, years ago, like I said before, yes, I think so. I think that today, at least the way we handle it, not so much. But people getting blindsided by it, yes, I could see that.
Go ahead, Tiffany.
Well, one of the things that unfortunately happens for people is if you're in a situation where you're not around close family and friends, say that you're in a situation in an airport and you have someone who's going through that has dementia, the people that are doing security may not understand enough about memory loss to realize that they have to lead that person possibly step by step through something. And we actually had one of our families share an experience exactly like that. And it was actually the wife of the person that had the disease. And she shared that at the end of this, when they figured out that this person was affected by Alzheimer's, that they made this sign by the temple, the universal sign for something's going on that's wrong up there.
Mm-hmm. But crazy.
And that's the way people will respond a lot of times. It's very disheartening for families.
Has this changed at all as people have become more familiar with Alzheimer's and what it is and how many people are experiencing it?
I would say yes. And one of the things that we always talk about at the association is that we can't get where we want to go with this disease if we can't talk about it. And we're always sharing this idea that knowledge is power. And when someone is living with the disease, whether it's them themselves that have it or their care partners, one of the things that we want them to do is figure out how they want to fight. And able to do that fighting, you have to be able to step out and say, yes, I have this disease. If you think that you don't know someone that's affected, you're wrong, because I am, and this is what I'm doing to help.
You know, one of the things you hear from time to time, obviously in extraordinarily bad days, people joke about Alzheimer's. I must be getting Alzheimer's because I forgot where I put my car keys, that sort of thing. How does that contribute to what we're talking about?
Well, it's one of those things that just makes people feel like, wow, even if I had this idea that I wanted to share this very personal thing in this situation, you've just shut me down. Because what I'm feeling is I'm just feeling like if I give you this personal part of me, that you're not going to respect it. And it makes people just retreat even more. And it makes that conversation that's so vital almost impossible.
Doctor, given the fact that you're so fully immersed in this whole subject, how do you react when you hear people joke?
Well, I think that what it is people simply don't understand the disease. It's a frightening illness. It's uniformly fatal. People try to make lighthearted comments about it because they don't understand it. They're ignorant about it. We haven't got, as Tiffany is indicating, we haven't been empowering people to go and talk about their illness so that we can dispel some of these myths. Many people with early stage Alzheimer's disease are quite normal and still contributing in many, many ways. They have much to give, and we shouldn't joke about them or write them off. However, I think there has been a progression of tearing down some of the myths about Alzheimer's disease dementia. I remember, Tiffany is far too young, but I remember when President Reagan and Mrs. Reagan announced that he had Alzheimer's disease in 1994, and that was quite an admission at that time. And that helped, I think, indicate it's all right to talk about Alzheimer's disease and affecting me or my family. But the other thing, the other aspect, I think, that will help dispel the stigma is, one, is more knowledge, more understanding about the disease, but second, having effective therapy. If we had something to offer people, they would come forward and they would get diagnosed and they would get the appropriate treatment.
Joe, just a quick response from you with regard to the people who make light of all of this.
Well, I hate to tell you folks, but my family makes light of it as much as we can. It's a defense mechanism for us, but we do. Just to give you an example, one time my mom was getting very frustrated with something, and my dad patiently patted her on the hand and said, "Now, Denise, you got to remember, I forget these things." And we all laughed about it, and we use humor as a defense mechanism with this disease. You might see that as wrong, but it's definitely done a lot to help us get through it.
Tiffany, do you see that as wrong?
Not at all. I always talk to my families and I remind them that humor is one of the things that will help you get through this disease process intact. But there's a difference between things that you guys are doing and you're discussing, a way to kind of normalize and let off steam, as opposed to the kind of dismissive things that people might do if they are not themselves living with the disease. And that's what we don't want to happen.
Sure, I understand.
What other advice do you and does the association have for dealing with the stigma?
Well, we want people to be open and be direct. If you have an opportunity to be an advocate for yourself, you hear someone say, "Well, I think that Alzheimer's is just something that happens as you get older. It's almost inevitable." And you know that's not true. Take that opportunity to educate them, because the more knowledge is out there, the less we're going to have to deal with this sort of thing.
Well, how do you become educated?
Well, there are lots of ways. We want people to feel connected. Of course, they can go to our website, alz.org. We have lots of fabulous educations there for people that love to do the online thing. I prefer the personal touch. So if you give us a call at 800-272-3900, you can talk to people who are caregivers now who know exactly what you're going through. They can hook you up with some of our fabulous classes. There are lots of ways.
You've been listening to the earlier part of the program. Mm-hmm. I am sure that you personally and the association as an organization probably pretty excited about what Dr. Morris and his fellows are up to.
We are extremely excited. I actually got to be a student in one of Dr. Morris's programs a little earlier this year, the Clinician Partners Program, and it was so fascinating. I'm always looking to add to my own knowledge base. And when I think about the idea that all of the things that we know about the disease and the breakthroughs and Mr. Reagan's very brave disclosure, all that's happened in my lifetime. So, you know, I always want to point that out and say, hey, this is one of those things where I don't want you to not have hope.
Doctor, where are you going to find the people to participate in this study?
We've had a tremendous interest, as you might imagine, for the Diane study of family members. They, just like Mr. Heinrichs is so elegantly described, been living with this disease without hope for many years, and they can trace it back many generations. So now that there's the opportunity to have prevention trials beginning, we have had interest from all over the world from family members who wish to participate.
How do they find out about it?
So we have a website as well, www.dian-info.org.
And you're still looking for as many people to be?
Absolutely.
How many people would you have to make an effective study?
So we want about 300 individuals to participate in this study overall. But remember, this is just the initial phase, and we plan to continue to recruit and enroll people beyond that. So anyone who is interested who comes from a family with a known causative mutation for Alzheimer's disease, please visit the website, www.dian-info.org. We would be happy. On there are phone contact numbers as well, and please communicate with us however you're most comfortable.
We'll put a link to that website on our website, stlpublicradio.org, as well as to the Alzheimer's Association. We were talking about stigma, and still are to a degree a moment ago. Do you think that stigma will have any impact on the number of people who might become involved in this trial or any other studies that you're doing?
Well, to some degree it is, and the Heinrichs family is remarkable, but we run across families in which some people are very committed, want to participate in the research, and others don't want anything to do with it whatsoever. They want it to be put aside. They don't want to think about it. They don't want it brought up. So I think that if the trials do have success, that will bring people more out of the woodwork, and if they see some hope and they can participate and hopefully benefit, then I think that will really attract people. But I think there's another aspect to the stigma that Tiffany was discussing, and that is it's not simply the people who could be affected, the participants, but we have to get the word out to the medical profession. Many doctors are uncomfortable evaluating and diagnosing dementia, and even when they diagnose it, they tend not to tell their patients for fear they'll harm the patient. Now, patients and families want to know, but often physicians are reluctant to give them a dementia diagnosis. And by the way, I should just, for listeners, should just clarify, we've used terms Alzheimer's disease and dementia. They're not necessarily the same thing. Everybody who has the brain disorder, Alzheimer's disease, will develop dementia. That's a loss of memory and thinking abilities. But not everybody who has dementia will have Alzheimer's disease. Other brain disorders can cause that. It always is very beneficial to get a good diagnosis if you think someone has changes in their memory and thinking rather than just assuming that it's Alzheimer's. Now, Alzheimer's by far the most common cause of dementia, but it's not always Alzheimer's.
We have a couple of calls. Let's get them in as time allows. And Sarah Lynn and Kirkwood, thank you for waiting. You're on the air with Tiffany, the doctor, and Joe.
Hi, I was just wondering. People with trisomy 21 Down syndrome are predisposed to develop Alzheimer's at an early age, and I was wondering if this particular sort of genetic research is applicable to working with people with Down syndrome, or if it would possibly lead to help for those people as well.
That's a very good point. You're quite right. People with trisomy 21 Down syndrome are at very high risk of developing Alzheimer's disease and Alzheimer's disease dementia, and again at an early age. There are advocacy groups to try to extend the sorts of studies that we're doing in DIAN to individuals with trisomy 21. To date, that hasn't occurred, but we certainly are aware of this model of early onset Alzheimer's disease. And if we can find success with the DIAN participants, certainly we think that, that potentially could benefit individuals with Down syndrome.
We'll bring in Lisa now, calling for Memory Care Home Solutions. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. You know, in this vast world of family caregivers who are struggling to be the best caregivers they can be, there are some wonderful resources out there. And one of them is the organization I founded after being a caregiver called Memory Care Home Solutions. And we're here to help train caregivers and to tell them about terrific projects that are going on in the community, like the Diane Project, but also things that they can do in their home to deal with wandering, rummaging, hoarding, and constant repetition. And we're here to help them. It's free. People can call us at 314-645-6247. We're here to help caregivers.
Lisa, thank you so much for the call. Tiffany, are you familiar with this organization?
I am, and one of the things that we love to do with the association is let people know about all the resources in their communities. So if they go to our website, alz.org, we have a list of everyone from home care people to people that are able to help you in the home to attorneys, whatever someone might need. And yes, it's a great organization.
You know, caregivers are kind of the forgotten crowd in all of these discussions, and they play such an important role and such a difficult role. I'm sure you're obviously well aware of that. And what can be done to give these folks kind of a shout out for what they do?
Well, first, we want to say thank you. I mean, when you look at the kinds of hours of unpaid caregiving that people are giving, it's staggering. And we want to make sure that those people don't feel alone, that they feel supported, because unfortunately, a lot of times what will happen with someone who's a caregiver is they get so wrapped up in taking care of their loved one with dementia that they neglect themselves. So we want to make sure that we hook them up with support groups and with respite, that we give them some place that's safe for them to be able to talk about what's going on with them and to share all the feelings that they have.
Joe, I'm sure you would give a right on to that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, and I would say that the Alzheimer's Association here in Iowa and all throughout the country has done such wonderful work working with caregivers. I encourage people, you were talking about being afraid of the stigma. The Alzheimer's Association has so much support. You know, again, 30 years ago it wasn't there. This is another exciting part of dealing with this disease, is that there has been so much done to help the caregiver, help the family deal with this disease, and it's exciting, you know, as exciting as you can get about Alzheimer's, to know that there is support out there.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and Doctor, I want to come back to you with regard to symptoms. You know, we talked a moment ago about forgetting the car keys. And people might joke about that. What is happening when people think that they might really have a problem?
So first, Alzheimer's disease, dementia, increases as people get older. But getting older per se does not lead to Alzheimer's disease, dementia. It's very possible to be 85, 90, 95, 100, and be fully intact in terms of memory and thinking. What dementia means is a person has declined in his memory and thinking abilities. That's number one. But number two, to a degree that it impairs their ability to carry out usual activities. So forgetting your car keys, but then being able to retrace your steps and find them and get in your car and operate it, that is not dementia. Thinking of trying to introduce someone and being unable to think of a person's name right at that moment is embarrassing, but it doesn't prevent you from saying, I forgot your name, and going on and having a conversation. So as long as you're independent and these minor memory lapses do not interfere with your daily activities, that is not dementia. And we want to make a world where everyone can live to age 85, 90, 95, and keep all their memory and thinking abilities intact.
Well, let's hope that the study is a first big step in going that particular route. Dr. John Morris, I want to thank you so much for being with us from Washington University School of Medicine. Most informative.
It's been a pleasure.
Joe Heinrichs, thank you so much for being with us. We wish you the very best, of course, in the forthcoming trial and hope for very positive results for you. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And Tiffany Phillips from the Alzheimer's Association, thank you for joining us as well. It's nice to see you. Some valuable advice for people out there from you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at how St. Louis school businesses, municipalities, and homeowners are using green practices to make the region more sustainable. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.